Welcome to the Follow My Lead podcast, where we transfer stories and best practices of today's leaders to the leaders of tomorrow with your host, John Eads.
Welcome to Season 5, Episode 2. I'm really excited you're here because you're going to get to hear the deepest conversation I've ever had to date. This was real. It was authentic. Dr. Shan Furch joined us on the show. He's a professor at Gonzaga University. He is also a consultant and helps companies really bring servant leadership and servant leadership mindset into their organization as a helping them improve their performance as a business. He's one of the most thoughtful and unique men I've ever talked to. It was just a fascinating dialogue. I originally found out about Dr. Furch from his TEDx talk, The Greatest Work of Art is to Love Someone, that's had almost 60,000 views on YouTube from 2013. He's a wonderful man. We get real deep on this show, so I'm going to forewarn you, if you're not into that, you might want to go elsewhere, but I'm telling you, this can make a big impact on your life. It's going to make a big impact on mine. We talk about love in the workplace. We talk about leadership in the workplace. We talk about parenting. It's just a fascinating discussion. So without further ado, here's my conversation with Dr. Shane Furch. Just a quick housekeeping item. This podcast is brought to you by LearnLoft, an organization focused on teaching modern professionals how to add value to their organization and the world. Their upcoming webinar titled The Modern Leadership Playbook, Optimizing Your Team's Performance, is live in November at 1 p.m. on November 2nd. Save your spot at resources.learnloft.com/webinar. Well, Dr. Shan Furch, we appreciate you being on the show.
Great to be here. Thanks a lot.
You probably don't know this, but it's really the power of the internet. I saw your YouTube video on the greatest work of art is to love someone, and it made just a tremendous impact on me. I think it had like 50 or 60,000 views, but it was from 2013, and I was like, this guy is amazing. So I wanted to first start by saying thank you for taking the time out of your schedule and having the confidence to go out and do a TEDx talk.
You know, it's always a blessing. I mean, it was strangely, you see a TEDx talk, and there's so much behind probably anybody's TEDx talk. But I had some great mentoring by my wife's father for years and years on speaking. And when they asked me, it was funny. I said, I think you should have my wife do it because I think she's a much better speaker than I am, you know. But yeah, it was a good opportunity, and just wanted to kind of get down into the heart of the person and how the masculine and the feminine are designed to be in harmony rather than in fracture, and how that's symbolic of, I think, race and culture, gender, sexual orientation, and all the places that we stand in fracture around the world consistently.
Let's dig into that a little bit. It's an interesting topic. Give us the holistic, for someone that hasn't seen the TED Talk and hasn't seen some of your work and writing, give us a high-level overview of that tension that you're talking about in masculine/feminine.
Yeah. So, you know, there's so many different ways to go about that. If we went with the conceptions that bell hooks has come up with, that would lead us into a beautiful place. And hers, so maybe we'll start with her. She's one of the nation's greatest thinkers, profound feminist, powerful uniter of the country, while also leveling some very important truthful critiques against the nation. Specifically, she says that America is white, patriarchal, and supremacist, and everybody swims in that water whether they know it or not. I tend to agree with her. She got a lot of her thought out of looking at critical race theory and just her own brilliance. And she also was connected to Paulo Freire, if you're familiar with Pedagogy of the Oppressed. But the ideas behind that are that people oppress other people, and there are only a few things that will change that tide. What she mentions is love itself changes it. And people have to watch out, because when power shifts and it goes to, and revolution happens and power comes up from the people down below, typically it's going to be a revolution into another generation of oppression, because that generational darkness just transcends time and place and people, you know. unless we infuse that with love, which from my perspective, the world religions point to that. My own faith, which is a faith that is towards Christ, towards the body of Christ, that symbolism and reality of a body sacrificing for other people, for other bodies, is sort of at the core of it. But so Bell Hooks speaks to that. She also, I think, leans into Martin Luther King Jr.'s idea that the oppressor will never willingly give up power. So in most cases, we can see the disparities across the races and the kind of national illness that happens if we don't have harmony among genders, races, socioeconomic class, and we get farther and farther apart and nearer to ultimate fracture. You can feel the pain and you can feel the disintegration. You can feel people finding it very hard to love one another and trust each other and come into an in-depth relationship across those areas. So Bell Hooks would probably be a good place to start. But Carl Jung also has some powerful work on the masculine and the feminine. And then John Gottman's work on how people tend to fracture and then how they can come back to harmony has also been important.
Well, you mentioned power and you mentioned the not wanting to give up power. At the same time, you mentioned love, right?
Yeah.
How do the two intersect? You talk a lot about people in power and you learn some things from your father-in-law. Tell us that story about, you know, maybe one of the lessons you learned about power from your father-in-law that's been so important.
Yeah. So, you know, the second part of Martin Luther King's two-part invention or his two-part miracle, really, which, you know, everybody's got their own stance in life. And some people, for example, would want to heavily criticize Martin Luther King, maybe for his personal choices, the possibility of the affairs. And some of that is important because all of us have hypocrisy. And I often say that's similar in a way to criticizing King David, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's just a lot of truth that people, you know, all of us have our shadows. And yet there is this beauty that transcends who we are. And so the second piece of that, when he said the oppressor will never willingly give up power, is incredibly important. He also said, when we love the oppressor, we bring about not only our own salvation, but the salvation of the oppressor. And I think that has such resonance. And when I first noticed that, I think I was coming up through my family and basically feeling oppressed by my very intense, sometimes physical, often angry father, and my mother, who tended to be the opposite reaction, depressed, walked upon, often oppressed. So I came up out of that. They themselves went through many years of healing and came out, thankfully, the other side, which is just a credit to their own courage. However, coming out of the family, I remember thinking, love exists. It's just that we don't have a grasp on it. We don't quite know how to get to it. And I first saw that when I met Jennifer's dad. And one of the key moments was just how any of us, whether it's people individually or inside a marriage or inside a deep friendship or inside our nation, across divisions inside the nation and nation to nation, you know, a key symbol of health is how much health we're able to give to others. And I think that's kind of impossible to give health. And if you go to servant leadership from Robert Greenleaf, to give health, wisdom, freedom, autonomy, a deeper ability to serve, if you're able to give that to someone else, that pretty much means that the person who's giving that away has to really work on themselves so that they're healthy enough to do that. And I find when I came into my wife's family, I noticed that her father and mother had that ability. You came away from them and you always felt just a little wiser, a little more healthy, a little more healed, you know. You felt more deeply loved. And so one example of that is the individual all the way up to the nation, the ability to admit fault, to make amends, to ask forgiveness, and not to just put the heaviness or the weight of the problem on the other person that has been harmed, but to actually ask forgiveness and make amends, make plans of atonement, plans of reparations. That's something that America has really struggled with over the years, and I think we're going to come into it in the coming decades. There's so many great examples of nations coming into asking forgiveness and making legitimate atonement based on what the beloved other who has been harmed would ask of us. You know, what kind of atonement would they ask of us? You know, go ahead.
Well, where I want to dig in here, I think it's a really fascinating subject, and it's deep, and I love that, right? I mean, very rarely do you get to talk to this level of depth, one, in corporate America, for sure, but even, two, in our own families, in our own home life. I mean, how much of our most home lives are just real problems are swept underneath the rug, right? I mean, we just act like they're going to go away. In reality, it really hurts us in the long run, doesn't
well,
it?
Well, that's the difference. Like when I came into her family, which I think any healthy family is capable of it, or any healthy corporation, I actually took over the years, I actually took what I learned from her family, and that's what I do as a leadership consultant inside companies around the country now, is help them access those avenues of health and wisdom and freedom. But a big part of it is actually the ability of the members to notice their faults, ask forgiveness, and change, and do that in a sincere way. And have yet to see it not work. It works profoundly, you know.
Well, it's so funny, is so many of the leaders today are power figures or power people, right? They have that assertive profile per se, and many of those people struggle with self-awareness. So you're exactly. really intersecting. You know, you have to have a leader that's self-aware enough to have these types of relationships and have these types of dialogues, but the profile of most corporate leaders tends to not be self-aware. And so
back to bell hooks, that profile is usually white and male, privileged and unaware. And so therefore that part's hurting the nation, not anything against white males, but we're talking against ego,
mm-hmm.
against a lack of humility, you know, a lack of awareness and understanding of the other, the beloved that's on the other side of us. So Jen's dad, I remember the first time I was sitting at the kitchen table, and he and his wife, Susie, his name's Fred, and Susie had a little bit of an exchange that was, I mean, I don't know if I totally picked up on it really. I think she said something like, hey, I think you need to look at this. And then I think he said something a little sharp like, hey, I'm speaking here, you know, a little bit sharp, maybe a little anger in it.
Right.
But literally it was very small on my family's 0 to 100 verbal violence scale. It was a -8. So I didn't pick it up. I think I actually thought that was pretty kind. And so
that was a good way to talk to her.
Yeah, pretty good. And later I was sitting on the couch and I saw him and her talking at the kitchen sink. And then he came over and sat next to me and he said, I'd like to ask your forgiveness for my rudeness, for that sharp tone of voice and my dominance there over my wife. That's not something that I believe in or want to be as a person. And I'd like to ask your forgiveness. And so that was the first time I heard any adult male ever literally ask forgiveness, you know. And that was huge for my life. I was young. And when that happened, you know, what I said was, oh, you don't have to ask me, you know.
I'm just trying to date your daughter.
Yeah, exactly. Just trying to get us off the hook and out of this conversation kind of. And he says, no, I don't ask just for you. That's a part of it. But another part of it is, you know, when we wrong each other in our family, we ask forgiveness of the person who was harmed and of everybody else that was present in order to restore the dignity of the person that was harmed. And I had actually seen him do that in his company, which is a large multinational company, after a meeting, and everybody had kind of dispersed across the campus, and he had had sharp words in the meeting. You know, about an hour later, he comes into my office, and I was the 15th person he'd asked forgiveness of for that moment, after asking forgiveness of the person that he was rude to, you know. So there's no package, there's no like bottled up thing that you can give to somebody. It's more about, you know, that quest for the depths of the inner life with oneself, with the beloved other, and ideally, in my opinion, with the divine. And you know, I think each person has that connection, though we all have it uniquely. And my vision of what's beyond me may be actually atheist or agnostic. I think we can sort of feel within us this quest for a legitimate harmony below fracture.
How do you respond to the people that say, well, that's weak, right? I mean, that's a sign of weakness. How do you think – I mean, I think that's most people's first reaction is, if I was like that at work, right? Yeah. If I'm not the CEO, or if I'm if I come off like that at work, I'm going to come off as weak, and I'm going to get run over in this dog eat dog world that I live in.
Yeah, that's a great point.
You know, what say you?
Great, that's a great point, but we got to look at balance. So I would talk with that person. I'd probably say, if that's all you've got and you don't have a grasp on love, then I can predict that all of your relationships are in a setting of disintegration right now. You know, because that element that you're talking about, where I have to be powerful and I never apologize, is no way to be in relationship. So we'd talk about that first. Then I would talk some more about the idea that everybody needs a balance of love and power. And we'd have a conversation about, where do they see that? What does it look like? How much of a grasp do they feel they have on that? You know, and for example, back to Martin Luther King, another statement of his: love without power is weak and anemic. Great point.
Love without power is weak and anemic.
Which is exactly what that person's saying. The person you're talking about. Good point. They agree with Martin Luther King Jr. They just haven't decided to look at the second piece, which is a holistic way of looking at the world. Power without love is abusive dominance. And that's just true, right? Both of those things are true. So they're mysteries that we would all, I think, want mentoring to go deeper into if we want to understand them. We can always walk along the surface and do typical corporate life or typical family life in a way that doesn't work. I mean, the whole nation's practically doing that, with levels of how much people dislike their work, levels of how much they dislike their marriages, you know. But if you get into the mature grouping of companies and the mature grouping of families, they look totally different, and they are definitely okay with and understand and embody a balance of love and power.
Yeah. It's just such powerful stuff, Shan. I mean, I'm almost blown away that we're getting a chance to talk about it. It's exciting to me, because you just don't hear this language every day in corporate America. You don't hear it. You don't hear it in 99.9% of offices across the world.
Right.
How does someone that is, you know, has that feeling of that they love at a deeper level, and they buy into all this stuff you're talking about, how do they go about then taking that stuff to the office?
Yeah, I think any great grassroots movement around the world, it just starts with a few people gathering together. So nobody has to have formal power. You don't have to be the CEO. It's helpful if you're on the leadership team. It's helpful if you're up there, because you can help infuse the whole company with it directly that way. But that's really not the answer, right? I mean, the capitalistic ascent is an important part of democracy, but it's not the core or the heart of it. It's one arm of it, you know, and we have to watch out for it, because it can get so egotistically driven. It brings me back to Bonhoeffer, whose family was an exceptional leadership family in Berlin. Bonhoeffer, the great theologian who was killed in the concentration camps of Germany. And his statement: money is dirt. I don't want to like ruin your show here, John, but
no, I go after it.
You know, this is what the point is: people can definitely live at a high level of capitalism, finances, economic generation, and that's important for all people to grow and live better. And obviously, if it's geared towards helping the whole society heal, then that's great. However, people can get super lost there as well as in their families. And that level of being lost usually enacts itself darkly, sometimes violently, against others, always towards fracture. And that ends up, companies end up having to do a lot of healing, or just crash and burn everybody and start again, or fire this many people. And
high turnover, et cetera.
Yeah, that'll get our bottom line. But if you look at companies like the top 20 servant-led companies around the country, you remember that book, Good to Great, by Collins?
Of course.
Great book. I think it was 11 companies that he ended up coming down to that had the great thing. And now I don't quite know how many are still alive, but there's quite a few that have dropped off, which is interesting. Not to over compare, but if you look at the top 20 servant leadership companies. So if we take just the Good to Greats, they were, I think their performance was around 18%, which was amazing, you know, economically, of gain in general each year, you know, of you know, much higher than your typical, you know, SNL, you know, and, the top place.
500s.
Yeah. Well, much higher than that, but also just like wherever we all put our retirement money, right? That's we're thrilled if we can get 10% over 10 years, you know? So good to great at 18 was amazing for everybody to see, you know? And then Don Frick did a study on the top 20 servant leadership companies. So these are more directly like what we're talking about. So good to great is excellent. And you have these leaders that were a combination of fierce, disciplined to the vision and modesty, which is beautiful. Modesty is very, very closely aligned with being willing to admit your faults, you know. And then you go to servant leadership companies, which would be, in my opinion, just a more full expression, just more fully, holistically going in those directions. And the numbers on those is 23%, which is fascinating, you know. So, you know, you always get this thing like, well, you gotta command and control them if you want to get the most out of your capitalism, you know. Actually, not true. You love them, you get even better results if you are willing to do the hard work of what love means, you know.
Well, it's fascinating, right? I mean, the whole idea of people over profit versus the other way around. I mean, I think so many companies, when downturns come or whatever, they tend to make cuts in people versus, you know, making a collective effort to improve the bottom line. And I think that takes a servant, more self-actualized, more self-aware leader to be able to do that. And so I do agree with you. I think there's a movement. I think people like you are a big part of why this movement is beginning to take foothold in America, as more young professionals, as people that you're teaching in college get into organizations and then get to leadership positions in organizations. I think you're starting to see a real shift, and which is why you have so many people interested in this type of a leadership approach.
You know, and I think there's so many good things out there now, and there's so many ways, right? Authentic leadership, relational leadership, you know, leading from the balcony, you know, a lot of Heifetz work, a lot of Meg Wheatley's work. There's so many great examples out there now. Servant leadership being one of them, appreciative inquiry, another one. There's so many. And if you're talking about that person in the company, how do they do that? I still go down to let's get together, the two of us, or and let's each bring somebody else. Let's have a group of four or five, and let's just read on this stuff and start practicing it in our workplace.
I think one of the hardest parts about your world, higher education, theory, you know, and I asked this question in some of my, you know, colleagues or friends that are in the space too, which is, how do I go apply it, right? I mean, this stuff's great. This I get so jazzed up and jacked up when I read this stuff and I think about it and it really gets my brain engaged. And me being a type A, like, well, where's my game plan? What do I go do next, right? And I think to the work of Carl Jung, who basically, to net it out, says, I can't do the work for you, right?
I think there's a lot of truth to that, but then there's also a ton of writers that are also type A, you know? Mm-hmm. So if you take the book called The Servant Leader, and I'd really identify with the mystery, and I think it's best to leave things formless as long as possible and not try to stamp forms on them, you know? But it is helpful to see, like, oh, what form did this person use in their company? Mm-hmm. And so James Autry's book, The Servant Leader, Greenleaf's more abstract, more like Carl Jung, doesn't really, you know, give steps, you know. But Autry does, many people do. Another book that's like that is Crucial Conversations by Patterson and three other authors. You know, these are books that are like, you can read it and tomorrow go do stuff, you know, in your workplace. And so I think it's a little combination of both, like loving the mystery and loving the linear, rational, let's go try this, you know.
Yeah, and I think it's just what the beauty of it, Shan, is that it's a journey, right? It's not a destination. It's not something that, you know, you just turn on tomorrow and the results are there. It's an investment of a lifetime.
Exactly.
And I love that. I think most people that want to improve embrace the challenge of it, right? Yeah. Embrace the challenge of keeping our ego aside, understanding the people involved in it, and knowing that it's not going to be easy, right? I mean, just yesterday, this is a personal example, but a 4.5-year-old son was not happy about having to go to church, and and he threw a fit. And, you know, when I picked him up, I said, we're going to get dressed. He went ahead and tried to hit dad. And I, at that moment, right, I mean, I was thinking, I can react to show power, right, to show that I am stronger, I am, you know, authoritative over him. I chose a different path, but without being self-aware, and I don't say this to brag. I mean, it might come back to hurt me later. I have no idea. but it took some self-awareness to say, this isn't about me being more powerful than him. This is about me loving him and teaching him right from wrong, not necessarily in force.
Love that.
It was hard. It's hard in the moment, right?
It gets super hard, and I think that's where we really need the linear expressions of how do we do this. And that's why mentoring is so incredibly important. And you're talking about maybe one of the most valuable, vital crucibles in the world, which is how to raise a son or how to raise a daughter, you know. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's the second most important one after how to be in love for a lifetime with one person, you know. That's super difficult, you know. And profoundly challenging, and yet the mentoring is so important. And I think of those moments when you said that with my three daughters too, and how we, you know, you get this mentoring, and it's so interesting. Like, instead of the use of power, how are we going to do it? You know, because I played college basketball and professional basketball, we ended up deciding with some of our mentors and counselors, you know, instead of over focusing on spanking or certain patterns of dominance, we would have a mutualized, you know, these are the things that we want to hold each other accountable to in the family. The kids can hold the parents accountable. The parents can hold the kids accountable. And it made it sort of simple and small, though sometimes you have to do some bigger stuff. But most things are very, very small and simple, you know, which would involve the admission of it, the asking of forgiveness sincerely, you know, and then a plan of atonement. And in our case, it has ended up being 5 lunges, 5 push-ups, or 5 sit-ups, your choice.
I like that. I'm like, you mind if I borrow that?
Yeah, totally. Go for it. And so, you know, they can do that with us. Like, anytime they see the parents with a bad attitude or with, you know, because we're basically, what we're parenting is the ability to, you know, be self-aware. So when your lack of self-awareness ends up harming somebody else. So whenever I do that as a dad, or Jen does that as a mom, you know, or they give us push-ups, or Now with mom, they want actually to have her pay them money because she hates to give away her money.
They find the real weakness.
Yeah, exactly. And so she's, you know, it's $5 if she gets angry or something, you know, and they're just thrilled, you know. And I'm like, yeah, you guys just keep doing it. Try to make her as angry as you can. You guys just get rich, you know.
Yeah. And she'll improve. And she'll improve. Well, let's end on some fun stuff. I know there's, you know, you mentioned basketball, you mentioned playing professionally. What's the greatest lesson you learned from basketball that you try to pass on to your clients and students today?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like that part of life is the same as that part of basketball, which is deep humility, deep gratitude, and pretty extreme forms of discipline, you know. So in basketball, if you want to, you know, if a person wants to go to those levels, the amount of hours, personal hours, a person has to put in are so sort of ungodly hard, you know. You get used to it and you grow to love it. And I feel like that's sort of part of the center of life. It's very hard to, and requires great discipline to live from a depth of humility and gratitude and growing, you know, but it's worth it. It's just really hard. The other, I think that's why we see so much fracture, because it's just so much easier.
What's the best investment that you've ever made? What would it be?
Oh, probably, yeah, I would say listening to finally finding a way to ask of the people around me, what do you see in me that you think would be good for me to consider or to change or to grow into, you know? And kind of that core of love that says I'm willing to do whatever it takes to establish legitimate love, forgiveness, atonement, and, you know, I'm here humbly. That's so I think I just got that from a few very crucial mentors, you know.
So you would say it's opening yourself up to be mentored.
And in the most crucial ways, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So some mentors are going to say things that are really, really hard to hear. I mean, you always want to have as loving a mentor as you can, but as wise a mentor as well. You know, they're going to say things like, you got to get rid of your defensiveness. It's ruining you.
Yeah.
You got to get rid of your pride, you know. Well, how would I do that? Well, How about if you stop at 5 o'clock each day with your whole family, sit down with them and tell them you'd like this plan where you sit with them each day at five and you ask them anything they noticed over the last 24 hours that had your pride or your defensiveness in it. And then you ask forgiveness and then you make some atonement, those mentors get serious with me.
Yeah. Well, and I think a lot of people, they don't know how to find mentors. They're afraid to ask for mentors. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not something that comes easily, particularly to a young professional, right? I mean, they get caught up in college life to finding the right job, and then, I'm not saying everybody, but then you kind of get into the party mode and working for the weekend, and, you know, unless you found some deeper meaning.
Who was that? Everybody's working for the weekend.
Yeah,
is that the boss?
Yeah. Everybody's work.
No, that was Loverboy in 1980s. There we go.
Well,
everybody's working for the weekend.
My wife would know it. my wife would know it. She gives me a hard time for how many songs I don't know the names who sings. But it's funny though. I mean, I think it's true, right? And I think that's why it needs to be talked about because so often we're afraid or we're thinking that person won't mentor me or. If I seek that mentor out or vice versa, I genuinely think people want to help. And
I agree. And there is nuance to it. Like, we know we don't want to come on too strong, but if a person just has some good balance and is okay with asking people and okay with those people being too busy and other people not being too busy, you know what I mean? Like, it definitely will come around. It's a purposeful movement.
Yeah, no question. I got a couple of my favorite questions to ask and one that I'm really excited to ask you, which is, what's harder, leading at home or leading at work?
That is really interesting. I would have said leading at home, but I would say the last 10 years has been more at work, probably because leading at home, there were so many crucibles in the first. So Jen and I have been together 30 years total now, and in the first 10 years were some of the most major crucibles. So once those have come into a place of peace in general, though we always got to work on our lives, and that's good, then it has become more at work. And maybe because I like larger challenges at work, like what do you do with raging assholes at work? What do you do with people that are too afraid at work? What do you do with groups that want to hate other groups at work? So I'm sort of more into those challenges in the companies I'm working in now, and which have to do with how do we get to down to where people can thrive with each other in harmony, while still having integrity to their emotions, their spirit, their way of life, but not at the expense of other people, And so I love those challenges, but so I would say at work it's harder now because probably just tackling some pretty severe challenge. What do you do with a CEO that has lost face at such a heavy level by directly harming workers, mm-hmm. and yet the overarching company wants to reinstate this CEO? What are we going to do with that?
So it's interesting. I've never thought of it changing as, time moves in a family early to late. And as work challenges change, and as careers change, it's an interesting. It's the first time I've heard that answer. So you're an interesting man. You're very deep, and the fact that you've taken such time, energy, and effort to put thought into this and to share it with others, I want to personally say thank you. Not only I think will be a great topic for our audience, but it's been great for me. And so I wanted to say thank you, and I appreciate you taking the time. But before we leave, I do want to mention a couple of things. You've written a new book called American Copper. Let's just talk briefly about American Copper, how it came about, and why you wrote it.
I mean, so I sort of think I think when I was coming up through graduate school, I didn't want to go to graduate school, probably just because I was raised in a family in Montana that often was associated with sports, and in the summers we were out on my grandpa's ranch, and so I had that sort of healthy skepticism towards what we might call the elite or something,
educational elite,
any type, maybe, like financially, educationally, etc. Though my family is also Czech and German, and everybody loved to read, and everybody also loves the depth of art and science. Sometimes it just felt like, well, I don't know if you need to keep going in school, And but I just did anyway because I was young. And And so that sort of gave me a love for science and for art because of the things I studied. I ended up doing a PhD in psychology, which had a lot of the positivistic science side to it, where you're crunching the numbers and looking at, you know, overarching causal laws in human behaviors, and just fascinating stuff. And then I ended up doing an MFA in poetry and fiction that was obviously more heavily the whole artistic side. So that's been my career at Gonzaga too, just books that are trying to be a unifier or holistic way of looking at the world through lenses that have to do with political science, social science, leadership, leadership theory, leadership practice, art, poetry, fiction, you know, all the different sort of lenses that we can put in there and get a greater grasp of something. So the scientific work from the positivistic or numbers crunching side on forgiveness is incredibly powerful, as well as the artistic side of forgiveness, or the more qualitative side. So that book, American Copper, is a novel that looks at American, we might call it American genocidal amnesia. So some of my younger life, I lived on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, and typically America wouldn't spent too much time thinking about the genocides that dominant culture America performed against the Cheyennes or the Blackfeet or the Nez Perce or so many different tribes, you know. But I wanted a book, a novel that would look at genocide. So it's based 1864 from the massacre of the Cheyennes at Sand Creek by the U.S. military on up to 1935 and the rise of Big Copper, Manifest Destiny, industrialization. And then inside it is some brotherhoods and sisterhoods that result in these movements towards forgiveness, atonement, and, you know, what legitimate love might look like in the face of power, you know. So that novel basically tries to look at those things through three lives: a copper baron's daughter, a Northern Cheyenne team roper, which is a style in rodeo, and then sort of a bigger kind of European American guy from poverty from the High Line of Montana who's a steer wrestler. So anyway, it's just a novel that looks at those things, and it's been a good journey with it. It's been out for about a year and it's done well, and I've been thankful. And so if some of the listeners are interested, that book's more on the art side. The book that I wrote called Forgiveness and Power in the Age of Atrocity is more along the lines of everything we've talked about today.
Well, awesome. We'll make sure to send people to the right places in the show notes. But it's Shan Ray with two N's, shanray.com. They can find all the resources and essays and bios and book reviews. It's just you're a tremendous asset to the servant leadership world and just thoughtfulness world, right? I mean, it's a refreshing perspective to hear, Dr. Ray, and I appreciate, Dr. Furch, and I appreciate you coming on the show. It's been a real honor for me.
John, I just appreciate you too, and thankful for your way of looking at the world and helping people come to a sense of legitimate community that, you know, I think a lot of times we get out there in the work world or in our world as families or parents or married people or not married, and it can feel so disheartening, and all the work you're doing creates heart and creates strength and courage. So great to be with you today, John.
Awesome. Thanks again, and we'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
I hope you enjoyed another episode of the Follow My Lead podcast. It's a real pleasure and honor to bring you stories to help you perform better at work and at home. It would mean a great deal to us if you'd leave a rating and review wherever you listen to the podcast, whether it be iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or Overcast. We get a chance to look at every single one of them, and it helps our exposure reach more people. Again, if you enjoyed this episode, it would mean a great deal if you'd share it. You can always mention at John G. Eads or any future guests you think we should have on the show. So until next time, be a great leader at home and at work.